ItaúViews, o seu podcast semanal que analisa as principais pautas da agenda econômica, abordando assuntos relevantes sobre macroeconomia, investimentos, tecnologia e análises setoriais. Acompanhe nossas conversas.
Hi everyone, welcome to our podcast ItaúViews. This is our second edition in English. I am your host, Marcelo Serrano, and I'm joined today by Fernando Gonçalves, economist at Itaú Unibanco, and Michael Hirson, practice head for China at Eurasia Group. Today we're going to explore one of the main issues on the international political and economic agenda, which is the relationship between China and the US beyond the trade war. We will address angles such as the technological race, cultural influence, FX rate reference, and how all of this could impact the Brazilian economy. Let's dive right in. Fernando, Michael, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Marcelo.
Thank you.
Great. Michael, since 2019, we have been watching the trade war between China and the US, its various chapters, and the impression we have is that rivalry has gone beyond just a trade issue. When you look at the relation between the two countries, what are the principal questions that come to mind?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This has gone well beyond the trade conflict. And I think the principal question is really how these two superpowers are going to coexist with one another. There are, I think, really two fundamental factors right now in the tensions between the two countries: geopolitical rivalry and a clash of ideologies. So on the geopolitical side, it's quite clear. We've got a rising China that is challenging the dominance of the U.S. in terms of economic influence, as well as, over time, military and diplomatic influence as well. And this has been, this has been developing, obviously, for a number of years, really since, probably the last 15 years, you could say. But it has become more intense recently, as China has now grown to challenge the U.S. in more parts of the world and in more sectors than ever before. And I think what's really important here to point out, because it gets back to the trade war, is the role that technology plays here, because technology is a cross-cutting issue in this rivalry. What I mean is it is essential for the economic competition between the U.S. and China, but also it's viewed as a national security issue and something that's important for the military competition. So that's why we see so much of U.S.-China tensions right now, even the trade war, really focused on these fundamental issues of technology supremacy and technology competition. And, on the ideology side, we don't mean sort of ideology with a capital I, like capitalism versus communism. I don't really think that's at work, but it's really about a clash of values. On the U.S. side, concerns over China's human rights and democracy and how China will project its political influence around the world. And on the Chinese side, concerns that the U.S. is looking to contain China and to challenge some of the fundamental political beliefs in his party. So it's those two key elements. And if you think about it, neither of those are going to go away. So when we think about what happens under a Biden administration, if Biden wins, or if we're even looking out, 4, 8, 12 years down the road, I think these are going to be durable factors and sources of tension in the relationship.
So, Michael, just to continue, you just mentioned on the U.S. election. Our first episode in English was actually on prospects for the American election. So I'd like to ask you, what do you see as the potential impact of these on the already troubled relations between China and the United States? Biden is talking about an increase in U.S. corporate taxes as well as in foreign profit taxes, which is typically seen as something that is going to be negative for the U.S. equities, but not so negative for the rest of the world. So might this and other policies in some way be to China's benefit?
Well, it's a really interesting question if we think about what will change for China if Biden is elected. And I think you have to break it down into a few different categories. You know, overall, obviously, one thing we need to focus on is what happens with the trade war, because obviously that has a material impact on China's economy. And I think what we'll see is Biden will look to probably gradually reduce the role of tariffs on China's economy, but it won't happen overnight. And Biden will, I think, you know, keep up a fairly aggressive approach in terms of sectoral sanctions on China, specific industries, you know, as part of the traditional Democratic Party belief that trade policy needs to support workers. So I think tariffs will be reduced, certainly relative to where what we've seen under the Trump administration, but it will be a fairly gradual process. Then I think we need to look at what happens with technology policy, because we've seen the U.S., you know, really launch an aggressive strike against Huawei in particular, but other Chinese tech companies. And here I think we will also see somewhat of a reduction in the level of aggression with which the U.S. pursues these technology aims. I think the Biden team is going to be worried about overreaching in terms of U.S. export controls and also sanctions and the role of the U.S. dollar, because they'll be worried about what this does for U.S. competitiveness over time. I think another area that we should think about is what happens with the reshoring of U.S. industry from China. And I think there's consensus in both parties in the U.S., the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, that the U.S. needs to move some industries from China closer to home. Now, that is not easy to do because China has some major cost competitiveness and other advantages, but we will see more policies in this area, whether it's a Trump administration or a Biden administration. And it will focus in particular on technology, some important technology industries such as semiconductors moving from Asia to the U.S., also critical medical supplies, and some sectors like rare earths. So I think these are areas that will have, I think, mixed implications for China that might look a little bit better than the trade war, but they are challenges that China will need to grapple with. On the tax policy side, I think you're right. This could be on the whole beneficial for China, but I think the impact of tax policy is going to be much less than when we think about these other areas, such as reshoring and the use of tariffs and the use of export controls and sanctions.
Great. Just highlighting now the tech environment, Michael. Many see Silicon Valley as the birthplace for tech innovation, but we have already discussed it here at Itaú Views how China has been assuming the lead of this. I'd like to ask you, how do you see this tech war between the two countries and how it might affect their respective economies? To get an example, the Ant Group, the payments platform of Alibaba, just announced that they will list its IPO on the Shanghai and the Hong Kong exchange instead of Nasdaq, which was always the premier choice for the tech sector. How do you see all of this?
Well, it's really interesting that you use the example of Ant Financial, because I think it captures two elements of this. The first is the tech competition part of this, and the other is the financial competition and the fact that the technology tensions that we're seeing, that we've seen over the last 2 to 3 years, are now starting to play out in the capital markets and decisions such as where Chinese firms go public. So, I mean, just starting with the tech side, I think this is a hugely important issue for both the U.S. and Chinese economies and really for the global economy. It's how the two sides will manage this tech supremacy. China has been catching up to the U.S. in a number of areas, and it's leading in some areas. There are some parts of artificial intelligence, like facial recognition, where China is ahead. Fintech, as you noted with Ant Financial, I think is a clear area where China is grabbing a lead. Other areas are much tougher, though, and China is very focused on how it can reduce its dependence on the U.S. in some of these critical areas of technology. And classic example here is semiconductors, where the U.S. has been so successful in its campaign, its pressure campaign against Huawei by restricting the use of U.S. semiconductors and semiconductor technology for Huawei. So China is racing to catch up, but there are limits to what it can do in the near term. So I think the bottom line here is that there is a significant degree of momentum behind decoupling between the U.S. and China in the technology sphere. It's not just coming from the U.S. side, it's also coming from the Chinese side, which again wants to reduce its reliance on the U.S. And for the global economy and these two countries, I think what we are going to see is a growing fragmentation of the two technology ecosystems in U.S. and China. It will be harder to view this as one technology market where innovation can be shared back and forth. And that's going to have implications for a lot of countries that will have to choose between rival standards and rival technologies in areas like 5G, which of course is a platform for a lot of industries. So this is, a problem in terms of the efficiency of global supply chains and the global economy. Now, on the financial side, this is where we're starting to see just this year the tensions really spill out. The U.S. is taking more aggressive actions to limit the access of Chinese companies to U.S. financial markets and really has actually outlined a plan to delist Chinese companies from U.S. exchanges, mostly for regulatory issues because of this concerns over the transparency of Chinese companies. But really what this means, and your Ant Financial example is great here, is that China is now going to be relying on domestic capital markets and Hong Kong increasingly as a source of capital as the U.S. financial system becomes less hospitable. And this is really driving a series of capital market reforms in China that are going to make Chinese capital markets more important globally than they've been to date.
That's very interesting. So, Michael, let me move to a discussion on currencies here. Some 60 years ago, Charles de Gaulle and government, French government officials were already talking about the exorbitant privilege of the United States given the dollar's position as the world's reserve currency and consequently not being subject to some balance of payments adjustment problems. More recently, a new debate has reemerged on the tendency towards the global weakening of the dollar in relation to the euro, yuan, and even some emerging market currencies. How do you see this debate? Do you think that the yuan has the potential to become the dominant currency eventually? How do you see this quote-unquote FX war developing?
Well, I think it's a big issue, certainly for the long term. I mean, we discussed China's concerns with being vulnerable and dependent on U.S. technology, and this is really now also starting to play in a very big way when we talk about currencies, where China's leadership is very worried about the U.S. weaponizing the dollar, so to speak. The problem for China is there's very little that China can do in the near term to reduce reliance on the dollar and the dollar-based financial system. But I think China is starting to take another run at increasing the international role of the renminbi. This will, I think, have to be gradual, because what China needs to really position the renminbi as a global reserve and investment currency is it needs deeper capital markets. Very importantly, it needs to liberalize its capital controls. And that's going to be, I think, quite difficult for China to do anytime soon because of fears of instability and some painful restructuring that still is taking place within the economy and financial sector. And then, you know, we also need to think about whether China has the institutional credibility right now to be viewed as a long-term investment currency. I think China looks good to many investors because of the stability of China's economy and even the stability of the political system. But this goes in cycles, and China looks very stable right now, but China will go through periods where it looks less stable and where it looks less predictable. And the challenge for China is that it's still a very opaque political system there's no central bank independence. There's a lot of questions about the institutional strength of different regulatory agencies. And I think all of this means that China will continue to go through cycles of stability and instability, which is going to matter for the renminbi and its ability to become a global reserve currency. And then finally, I would just say, the other wild card here is technology. China right now is developing a sovereign digital currency. It's in testing right now that China hopes will allow it to leapfrog other technologies, and that with this digital currency, it will be a pathway to broader international use of the renminbi. But I think the bottom line, for your question is there are limits to what China can do anytime soon. I think gradually the renminbi will continue to grow in international usage. And I think what we'll see, over the next 10, 15 years is the dollar, the euro, and the renminbi emerging as, sort of sharing the role over time of important reserve currencies. Don't count out the euro. I think, that it's also going to be a very important global currency.
Great. Very interesting. Michael, recently, another conflict has developed between the two countries. This time is in the social media area with the controversy surrounding TikTok, Facebook, and all data breaches. In the West, we have the United States as the dominant cultural influence. But do you see China as a dark horse increasing its influence in this field of activity as well?
I think China will be more influential here because of its technological sophistication and the size of China's markets, which means there's a lot of innovation going on domestically that can then be applied overseas. And, TikTok is a great example of this. It started as the domestic platform run by ByteDance, and then it was adapted for international use. I think the challenge, though, is that there is growing concern and to some degree suspicion of how what kind of influence China will be able to exert through its social media apps. And we see this right now with the conflict between India and China, where India recently banned TikTok and other Chinese leading apps because of a border dispute with China, but also more broadly, fears of Chinese influence and the data that China can collect. So I think the bottom line for me is that Chinese social media tech applications will have, I think, influence in a number of regions, but I think it will be harder to penetrate the U.S. and Europe and other areas where the geopolitical concerns with China are going to stay very pronounced.
Got it. Fernando, now it's time to address a question to you. Listen to Michael's views on these various aspects of Sino-American relations. How would you describe the potential impact of all of this for Brazil and for the Brazilian economy? And what might be the points to look out for?
Well, thanks for the question, Marcelo. I think, first of all, China is a major trade partner to Brazil today. It currently accounts for about 40% of Brazil's exports of meat, 60% of exports of oil and iron ore, and about 80% of our soybean exports. And for soybeans, exports certainly have benefited recently from trade tensions, as this has led to a shift in mainland China away from the U.S. In fact, Brazil's exports of soybeans reached record levels in the first months of 2020, in part because China has been making massive acquisitions of the product to replenish its stocks, with Brazil being, the main country of origin. Now, the trade war between China and the U.S. May also bring additional demand for Brazilian meat, especially pork, but also chicken meat, while Brazilian beef exports are expected to keep strong. Therefore, going forward, I think it's very important to see whether trade tensions remain high or diminish with the potential change in the presidential election, upcoming presidential elections. And it's going to be crucial to see what's going to happen there for most of our key exports. But I think it should also be noted that Trump announced on December of last year that the U.S. would impose steel and aluminum tariffs on Brazil and Argentina in response to what he has described as the country's massive devaluation of their currencies. So eventual changes in the U.S. political landscape could also impact us directly here, as this example shows. And another way in which U.S.-China tensions could impact us here is through technological disputes, some of the disputes that Michael has discussed. Recently, the top U.S. diplomat in Brazil said in a newspaper interview that the country may face consequences if it allows China's Huawei technologies into its 5G network, and referred to the U.S. Warnings that China fails to protect intellectual property. So in fact, as you can see, there are many channels through which the dispute between China and the U.S. can affect Brazil, ranging from commodity prices and commodity export volumes to technology adoption here, right? So, you know, many, many channels.
Okay. Thank you, Fernando. Michael, to conclude, how do you see all these elements over the medium term, when this, if you can say, Cold War Part 2 is over? What aspects will survive and become part of a new global financial architecture?
Well, I think if we're looking at over the medium term, you know, a lot of this is going to end up driving what I think is a really important trend that that a lot of our clients are still coming to grips with, which is, and maybe underappreciating, and that trend is China's emergence as a major power, a major player in global capital markets. You know, I mean, we're so accustomed to understanding China's role in the global economy and global trade, we sometimes forget that China's influence and its direct role in global capital markets is is relatively minor relative to the size of the economy. And this is because China has for so long had capital controls in place. Well, this is starting to change. China is opening its capital markets. It's doing so for economic reasons, but also because of the geopolitical concerns that we've discussed today, including wanting to reduce China's reliance on the U.S. dollar. And this is a trend that I think is going to have far-reaching implications for markets, but also for international relations. I mean, with more influence in capital markets, of course, comes more influence in other areas as well. And I think for countries such as Brazil, as well as the U.S., this is going to mean that developments that happen in China are going to have an even more direct impact on our financial markets and our economies at home. And I think there's some positive aspects to this. I mean, Chinese capital coming into global markets, I think is in many ways positive. It's going to mean, you know, more diverse sources of capital in the financial system. But I think we need to worry about some of the risks as well, and we discussed some of these. You know, China is still grappling with some serious economic issues at home, including a very high rate of debt in the economy. It's still a system that is not very good at communicating with the outside world, and where there's a lot of opacity, which means that we're going to see surprises in China, either in terms of the economic side and the political side. And when we see those surprises in an environment where Chinese capital markets are much larger and where the connectivity with global markets is much stronger, it's going to mean ripple effects globally. So I think this means that we all need to really be closely watching China, making sure that we understand China, because these ripple effects, we are all going to feel them more directly than we have in the past.
Okay, very, very interesting conversation. I'd like to thank again Michael and Fernando for their participation here.
Well, it's been great to be with you and great questions.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much, Marcel. It was a pleasure as well.
Este foi mais episódio do Itaú Views. Siga nosso perfil na sua plataforma de podcast e acompanhe nossos conteúdos. Obrigada e até a próxima.